next case on our calendar this morning for oral argument is the matter of 33 City Center Holding versus Rosa Mexicano Holding Company. I think that's right. And counsel, while you are getting ready, I don't know how we are doing with water glasses. Are there clean ones that are out there right now? Okay. It's a busy day here at the Court of Appeals. While you're getting situated, I'll remind you that you each have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. The podium can be raised or lowered to suit your needs. And when you are ready and settled in, then you may begin your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel Heather Marks, appearing on behalf of the appellant. My client's claims were taken from the outset without a determination on their facts under a misconstruction of Rule 12.03. The straightforward application of well-established Minnesota case law mandates reversal of the trial court's ruling. The Minnesota case law here is clear in regard to the Rule 12.03 standard. Judgment on the pleadings will not be sustained if, by a liberal construction, the pleading can be held sufficient. A Rule 12.03 motion is simply not a favored way to test the sufficiency of a pleading. Judgment on the pleadings is improper when questions of fact exist. It is completely immaterial for purposes of this court's review whether plaintiff can ultimately prove the facts that have been pled.
And then, Ms. Marks, under that liberal construction, under Rule 12, how does, as we noted, we plan on vacating at the expiration of the corporate guarantee, but would like to work towards a replacement tenant and coordinate with the landlord, indicate a unqualified renunciation or repudiation of the contract?
That is but one of the statements that was made by the tenant's agent. Paragraphs 16, 17, and 18 of our complaint each independently outlined three separate statements that were made to my client. The trial court's opinion here only focuses in on the paragraph.
And did any of those, just for the sake of argument, say, you know what, we are unqualifiedly renouncing and repudiating this contract? I'm going to go with probably not.
Right. No, no one uses those languages. But when you have an agent who comes in and says, we've got a 15-year restaurant lease here, comes in year five and says, we're shutting it down, we're vacating the premises. Now, there is some difference in what the agent is saying. Is it going to be September? Is it going to be December? Paragraph 17 of our complaint specifically reiterates his statement, we're shutting it down. When you have a 15-year lease and you're in year five, that is a renunciation of their continuous occupancy clause. And he tried to give us a little bit more context as to when shutdown might occur.
And it ended up being months later, right? 18 months or 16 months?
It occurred in October of 2016, 9 years before the expiration of the lease.
Can I ask you a couple of questions? I know Rule 12, usually we look just at the pleading.
Yes.
But we also look at documents that are incorporated. And here that would include the lease agreement, correct?
Agreed.
Okay. Given the fact that the lease itself provides three scenarios under which the tenant's vacation of the premises before the expiration of that 15 years would not be a breach, given that fact, how can we this court conclude that the complaint as the allegations as asserted primarily in paragraphs 15 through 18 of the complaint do indicate an unqualified and unequivocal renunciation?
There have to be certain actions undertaken in order for the tenant to vacate the premises and still not be in breach of the lease. Most notably, you have to work with the landlord to find a replacement tenant. We don't want this place sitting vacant like it is now.
Which is why you could argue that that's why there's this reach out beforehand, is to try to work with the landlord.
There is language that says we'd like to do that. There is no record here that indicates that they did do that. There is nothing in the pleadings to indicate that that ever occurred, that that advanced beyond a hypothetical.
Although they continued to stay on the premises and continued to pay the monthly lease payments.
Through October of 2016, they did. But we tried to avoid all of this confusion when we sent them a default notice. And we said, during the guarantee period, we sent the default notice not only to the tenant, we sent a copy of that to the guarantor. That's Exhibit 4 to our complaint. And we specifically said to the tenant, if you don't intend to vacate the premises, tell us. Repudiate, tell us that you're not going to leave. They never did. We told the guarantor, we're not waiving any damages, we're not waiving any rights, we're going to proceed as we intend to proceed. So this argument that, you know, somehow because they continued to pay rent and because we continued to accept it really puts my client in a catch-22. We've noticed an event of default under the lease. After that time, if we don't accept payment, then are we not mitigating our damages? Then we're going to be brought in and they're going to say, well, you didn't mitigate. We tried to tender payment and now you're alleging damages that shouldn't be there. Versus a waiver. So again, we've tried to get ahead of this in our very clear notice of default, saying that we're not waiving anything. We're not.
Of course, you know, one could argue that every time they paid the rent, you know, every additional month, you know, perhaps a prudent course would have been sent. Oh, and by the way, just because we're accepting your rent doesn't mean. You know, any rights were waived. Oh, and by the way, you still didn't respond, so we assume you're still in default. I mean, now that didn't happen either. Would that be a fair statement, Ms. Mark?
There's nothing in the pleadings to indicate that that happened either, Your Honor. But what is in the pleadings is a very clear statement that says, we understand you are not going to continuously occupy these premises. Your tenant or your agent has told us that. It's within the guarantee period. Tell us if we're wrong. And they never did. That's what's in the complaint, and that's what the trial court should have looked at. The trial court looked at only paragraph 16 of our complaint. Paragraph 17 and 18, those other subsequent notices, those other discussions, are never addressed in the trial court's opinion. She never examines those. And when she does evaluate one piece of the evidence that we offered, it's very interesting what she does. She says half of that statement, yeah, it's an unqualified repudiation. That is. The rest of the statement renders it equivocal. Okay, this is a Rule 12.03 standard. If there is part of the evidence that should sustain the pleadings, we should be allowed to proceed with discovery. We weren't afforded that right here. All of the claims against the guarantor were taken from the outset.
We understand we have de novo review, so to some extent what the district court's analysis is on the point is not germane given our standard of review. But, I mean, we do have to review the allegations in the context of the lease itself.
Yes.
And you agree with that?
I agree with that.
And you agree that the lease says that, you know, there provides the possibility of assignment and subletting as long as the landlord agrees with or approves that proposal. And so, again, how does the conversation in April or May of 2015 in the context of that provision of the lease and then the facts of how much longer the tenant resided there, how do we get to, as a matter of law, entitlement to recover for anticipatory breach?
Again, I would refer back to the lease, that if there is going to be someone else to essentially step into the shoes of the tenant, there are specific steps that have to occur under the lease. So if it's going to be the respondent guarantor's position that it's no longer liable because of some empty rhetoric that the tenant statement made that we'd like to work with you, there has to be something else to sustain the dismissal on the pleadings, indicating that they did work or that there was someone else. There is nothing in the pleading to sustain that type of holding here. There is one offhand reference, but if we take that offhand reference in connection with the terms of the lease, there is nothing in the record to identify that the terms of the lease have been satisfied in regard to assignment, subletting, or any of the other potential avenues. We would have loved for them to do that. We would love to have a tenant in the space. It's empty. You know, they walked 9 years early on a lease. So as a good business person, when somebody approaches you with alternative avenues, you pursue those. There's simply no record here to indicate that they did that. And certainly not a record sufficient to take it at a Rule 12 standard. If the guarantor wants to argue that there were subsequent actions taken, that there was something in the record that obviated the tenant's obligation to occupy the space for another 9 years, that's what discovery is for. That's why we should be afforded to flesh out the record. Instead, we didn't have that opportunity here. The trial court made improper and erroneous factual determinations, looking only at portions of the allegations that were stated in the complaint.
Well, respondents seem to argue that, you know, really, irregardless of an anticipatory breach or a waiver, you continued to receive payments well past the period of the guarantee. The guarantee was to make those payments during the period of the guarantee. You received all of those from the restaurant, so you have no damages. So there really is no cause of action left to address. How do you respond to that?
When the default occurs, there are other damages that come into play. The default occurs during the guarantee period. The guarantee is only excused if there's no default at the end of the guarantee period. Here we have noticed a default at the end of the guarantee period. There are multiple provisions in the lease that provide my client damages, not only the accelerated rent clause, but there are legal clauses. There are other sections in the lease. Section 19.01 addresses interest and costs. Section 19.06B addresses the costs of terminating and reletting. Section 19.06C identifies damages for loss of income. All of those damages come into play at the time of the default, which occurs during the guarantee period. So if they're going to argue now that all of those damages are zero, again, they're looking myopically at this. They're saying rent. There is more than rent at play here under the terms of the lease.
As against the guarantor or the tenant?
The guarantor steps into the shoes of the tenant. And when the tenant defaults, there are multiple avenues under the lease through which the tenant owes my client damages. And so on a Rule 12 standard, we have no basis here to say that under Section 19.01, which entitles my client to interest and costs, that that's zero. We don't have any record to say that there is a zero, that there's zero damages for costs of terminating and reletting, that there's zero damages for loss of income. That's simply vacant from this record.
You know, in an anticipatory breach, and I have to admit, it's been a while, for example, of this lease, what are your choice of damages?
There are multiple here.
Give me all of them.
Sure. Okay.
I mean, I assume it's insisting on performance and or getting, you know, the rent. I mean, am I right on that?
We can accelerate rent. We can try and insist on performance. I mean, that's obviously kind of an interesting approach. We have the right to step in and perform the covenants. So there are a number of avenues that my client can receive damages under. Most of them are in Section 19 of the lease.
So you're asserting then that if the breach occurred during the guarantee period, this acceleration of rent clause would put the holding company on the hook for the full 15 years of rent?
I don't know that that's the case. There's an acceleration that talks about a limitation. But again, if that applies here or not, we need to explore further. But there have been additional costs, undeniably. There are interests. There are costs for retaking the premises. There are legal costs. You know, there's a significant additional amount that goes into it when a breach of a significant lease like this occurs. It's not good enough for them to say, maybe we'll be here, maybe we won't, take our rent and see what happens. We did literally everything we could here. Their agent comes to us and tells us we're shutting it down. We send them a notice of default saying, here's what your agent told us. Tell us if that's not the case because we think you're going to walk on this lease. We're reserving all of our rights. We're not waiving anything. And they do nothing other than make these payments. Are they payments under the lease? Are they renunciations? I understand that they're going to make the argument that they have fully performed, that there's nothing left. That's what discovery is for. We're here at a Rule 12 standard.
So you're hoping for that extra email from this, Mr. Somerton is going to get it for you.
Well, we want to talk to Mr. Somerton.
You know, I bet you do.
Right.
And I bet he'll be sandpapered from here until the end
of time. I'm sure he will be. He's had plenty of time to be
Let me ask you this, Ms. Mark. So clearly, they have the burden under Rule 12.
Agreed.
Do you have the burden of proving that it's an of anticipatory breach?
We have the burden to plead sufficiently. And if we're going to plead anticipatory repudiation, I think we have to plead sufficiently to indicate that there are statements in the record, there are questions of fact, that there is a sufficiency of the evidence to sustain our claims. I think that that's our burden as the pleader.
As a matter of law?
I believe so. And I think that we've met that burden here. You know, I'll take that burden because we've made that. We identified not only three separate instances where their agent came to us and said, we're not going to be here for 15 years, in essence. We have an email from the tenant's agent saying, I've been hired to shut this down. We have pled sufficiently to sustain or to present facts, at least to present a question on whether there was anticipatory repudiation of this particular lease. I see that my time has expired.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Adam Hachikian. I represent the respondent along with Rachel Estoba, Rosa Mexicana Group Holdings, or as we've referred to them in our briefs, Rosa Group. As you've heard, this was a lease involving another Rosa Mexicana entity named Rosa Mexicana Minneapolis, or as we've referred to them, Rosa Minneapolis. Now, the first issue that I'd like to address is the breach of guarantee claim. And the plaintiffs have failed to state a claim because there was no breach of any kind. First, even assuming all the allegations are treated as true, giving all deference to the plaintiff, the trial court correctly held there was no anticipatory breach. But second, as Judge Flory alluded to, even if there was an anticipatory breach, there was no breach of the guarantee because the anticipatory breach that's being alleged here does not pertain to any obligations that Rosa Group agreed to in the guarantee.
Although there's a statement on paragraph 18 that there was an anticipated closing date of September 2015, that's still in the guarantee period, isn't it?
It is, but
so why isn't that at least enough of an allegation of anticipatory breach during the guarantee period to proceed with this litigation?
There's two reasons for that. First is the standard for anticipatory breach is extremely high. It has to be unequivocal and unrepudiated. As Space Center versus 451 Corporation held, anticipatory breach requires that the party cannot possibly perform. And here, as you pointed out in your questioning previously, when that statement was made, there were other options to be able to perform the lease obligations.
But there was certainly no indication in any of the statements, either in writing or in the conversation, of any intent to do so.
Well,
there was a vague reference to I want to work with the landlord, but nothing about, hey, we're looking for another tenant or let's assign this lease or any of the scenarios that the lease would provide.
Well, I would argue that you don't actually need to have those specific comments because the fact that the lease has these three options, as you pointed out, you could vacate with the landlord's consent, you could assign the lease, or you could sublease the space. Because those options exist, as long as the tenant has not yet breached, has not yet moved out, those options are still on the table. That means it can't be unequivocal that you're not going to do those things. We might have a different scenario if the statements were, we're moving out and we have no intention whatsoever of doing anything else. That's not what we have. In fact, we have something even more generous to our side, which is we're moving out and we'd like to coordinate with the landlord and trying to find a replacement tenant.
Well, why didn't they respond to the notice of default then? I mean, that would have cleared everything up right there, it seems to me.
Well, Your Honor, unfortunately, because I'm limited to the facts alleged in the complaint,
right,
I can't show you or argue.
But what's
specific.
I guess, the legal impact of the notice of default?
Sure. There is a response, but it's not part of the record, so it's not germane to this argument today. But I guess My point would be, even without having that response available to the court or as part of the record, I don't know what difference it would make if there had been a response. If the tenant had come back in response to the default notice and said, oh, geez, we're sorry, never mind, we're just kidding, Mr. Summerton doesn't know what he's talking about, does that suddenly make everything better? It doesn't make any difference. The fact is, there were other options on the table, and in addition, they continued to remain in the space. They continued to operate the restaurant. They continued to pay rent. So whatever it is that Mr. Summerton may or may not have said was rendered equivocal, as the trial court said, by their subsequent actions, which directly contradicted and belied his statements. You want a retraction? How about retract by action? Actually doing the thing that they want you to do, staying in the space, is a much stronger retraction than an apology note in response to their default notice. Now,
you know, but I mean, as Ms. Marks has been pointing out, you know that you may succeed on summary judgment. The question is whether all of this is successful on Rule 12. So why do you succeed on Rule 12 on the Rule 12 standard for all these things you're just telling me about?
Sure.
Because, well, I mean, I assume if we reverse this and come back in Rule 12, you know, the first questions are going to be from Ms. Marks to Mr. Summerton is, so, did you get a tenant to sublease? Did you get an assignment? Did you get a, you know, blah, 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 blah. And, I mean, I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, what's going to happen is going to happen. But shouldn't she at least have the opportunity to make these arguments?
Well, no, because I don't think it's relevant. In fact,
why? Because I mean, is your strongest? What I'm trying to figure out is what is the strongest response to what is clearly Ms. Marks's best argument is? This is all fascinating, but it's Rule 12. And is it? Well, I'll just leave you
okay,
to that
okay.
rather than what I think the answer is.
Sure. I think there's two separate responses to that. The first is you got to focus on. Sure, there's a generous standard for Rule 12. There's also a very high standard for anticipatory breach.
Right.
Okay? And so for anticipatory breach, the question is not, is it likely or is it more probable than not that the tenant was going to move out at some point? The question is, was it unequivocal? Was there an unqualified repudiation? So it doesn't make a difference whether or not it actually bore out that there was a replacement tenant or an assignment. The fact that those options existed, even if they were remote or unlikely, takes us out of the realm of unequivocation and unqualified renunciation. Now, you know, this court is obviously, as you pointed out, free to adopt any ruling it wants, whether it follows the bases that the judge below adopted or would affirm on a different basis. And one of the other arguments that the court did not rely on, which I think also addresses your concern, is that the landlord waived its rights here to enforce an anticipatory breach. And the reason I say that is because if in fact Mr. Summerton's statements in April or May were considered unqualified repudiations of the lease, well, then the landlord's remedy for an anticipatory breach would be, go ahead, terminate the lease, go ahead, retake possession of the space. You're saying that we've defaulted. But when they didn't do that, and they allowed us to stay in the space, allowed us to continue to pay rent and operate the restaurant, they waived that right. Effectively, it's an election of remedies. When you have the choice of an anticipatory breach, the whole purpose of that doctrine is you have the opportunity to go in and do something about a breach that you know is going to happen in the future, rather than wait for the actual breach to occur. Once the actual breach has occurred, in this case, the tenant moving out and stopping to pay rent, anticipatory breach is irrelevant. There's nothing to anticipate anymore. You've already elected the remedy of the actual breach. So, you know, for that purpose, I don't think there's
so,
anything.
I mean, 12, I can't sorry. I can't point to it right now, but at least in leases that I used to draft, there's this standard language that says, well, by us failing to do anything doesn't mean we've waived any rights. Is there some language like that in the lease?
I'm sure there is.
Okay.
Yeah, I believe
well,
there is.
Well, doesn't that, like, zero out what you just said to me?
No, I don't believe so. I don't believe so. And in fact, you know, we have cited other cases in our brief where the courts have previously said anticipatory breaches can be waived. And the fact that you have a
so they should have sued right away in April or May of 2015 for anticipatory breach.
If that's what they wanted. But that actually dovetails into the second point, which is it doesn't actually matter whether or not there's an anticipatory breach because they got the entire remedy that they were entitled to get from the guarantor. So even if you don't believe...
Well, except that if they proceed and prevail on their anticipatory breach, that occurred before the expiration of the guarantee period, did it not?
I agree, but that doesn't increase the scope of the guarantee. So the scope of the guarantee, regardless of when the breach occurs, is you get the performance of the obligations through the end of the guarantee term, the first 60 months of the lease. They got more than that.
But doesn't that presume that there's been no default during the term?
No. No, it doesn't. Because under the guarantee, if there was a default before the end of the term, what you're entitled to is that the guarantor should step into the shoes of the tenant and perform. So let's say you didn't pay rent in month 52. Okay, guarantor, you got to pay us the rent. All right? So all that they would get if they could have established in, you know, whatever month it is of the guarantee term that these statements were made, all they would be entitled to is get the guarantor to perform what the tenant was supposed to do. And that happened. The tenant did that all the way through the end of the guaranteed term and beyond. So and it's not in dispute that the tenant stayed in the space and continued to pay rent beyond the end of the guaranteed term. So under the plain language of the guarantee, there's nothing left for the guarantor to owe. They point to Section 6 of the guarantee, which says that the guarantor shall be released at the end of the guaranteed term if the tenant's not in default. What that does is it preserves your right to pursue a claim against a guarantor if the tenant's in default. It does not change
for the 5 years of the guarantee.
Right.
Not for the 15 years of the lease.
Correct. There's nothing in Section 6 or otherwise that says, oh, okay, if there's a default in year three or year four, then now suddenly you get to sue the guarantor for all 15 years.
You know, in all fairness, there's nothing in the guarantee, well, you tell me, that says, and no matter what, our guarantee is capped at no more than 12 times 5, 60 months lease payments.
Well, I think
would that be a fair statement? Well, that would help your argument a lot.
Yeah, I think if you look in the guarantee, which is attached as part of the addendum that was in the...
26 to 28 of the appellant's addendum. So
if you look at page 26, and it says that in section 2, it says that you should make any payment that comes due between the execution date and the last day of the guarantee term. And then at the end of that section, it says that, notwithstanding the foregoing, in the event the landlord terminates
possession. Where are you reading? I'm not following.
The bottom of page 26, the last sentence.
Oh, yeah, yes, I see. Go ahead.
Notwithstanding. Mm-hmm. In the event that the landlord terminates the tenant's possession of the premises pursuant to Article 19 of the lease, guarantor should be liable for a lump sum payment equal to the guarantee amount, okay? And if you look up above in 1D, guarantee amount is amount equal to rent during the guarantee term and some other amortization issues. So it plainly does say you're entitled to the amount due during the guarantee term. They got that. The remedies that counsel was invoking under Section 19 of the lease, as I believe you pointed out, Judge Connolly, are remedies against the tenant, not against the guarantor. And it's important to note that in Article 19, these accelerated options are invoked by the landlord retaking possession or terminating the lease. They didn't do that during the guarantee term because they were happy to have us continue to operate and pay rent. So, you know, they may be able to invoke those remedies against the tenant when they reentered the space after it was vacated, but that didn't happen during the guarantee term. That doesn't apply to the guarantor, and the obligations of the guarantor are capped. So they got everything they were entitled to. I believe that the court was right, that there was no anticipatory breach here. And my point is not that the plaintiff can't...
They got their entitled to from the guarantor, not from, obviously, the tenant.
Correct.
Walked
correct.
Out
and they have a judgment against the tenant. We have a stipulated judgment against the tenant for what the tenant
I'm sure
does.
That's worth exactly what it is.
Yeah. Well, and hence why
and
we're here.
And that's too bad.
Yeah.
And
hence why we're here. That's why we negotiated a limitation. Okay.
And if they were more concerned about the tenant, they could have gotten a 10-year guarantee.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And it just... What they're trying to do here is take a statement that occurred, before the end of the guarantee term and somehow have that expand the obligations of the guarantor to be unlimited for the entire 15 years. It makes no sense. If you had a tenant who was in there and paid 59 months of rent and didn't pay month 60 of rent, then the guarantor would owe 1 month of rent, not 10 years and 1 month of rent. And likewise, here, we're not even the tenant who only paid 59 months of rent. We paid more than 60 months of rent. So there's nothing to be owed. I see that my time is very limited.
You could always quit while you're ahead.
There is another count here. I'll just point out.
The unjust enrichment?
The unjust enrichment.
Yeah, don't bother.
I will not bother then, and I'll take your advice and quit while I'm ahead, unless the court has further questions, which I'd be more than happy to address.
I think we're good. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And Ms. Marks, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. Responding to what Respondents' Counsel indicated about the high standard for anticipatory breach, that's being confused here a little bit in his argument. There is no heightened pleading standard for this type of claim. We have to state sufficient evidence to sustain our pleading. This is not a fraud claim. This is not some other claim that requires us to undertake heightened pleading. This is still a notice pleading type of claim.
But I think what he's trying to say is that to state a claim, you have to demonstrate that the facts show not only statements are made, but that it's unequivocal and,
His argument goes to the sufficiency of the evidence, goes to the sufficiency of the allegations, goes to whether or not these...
As a matter of law, those allegations get you to an unequivocal repudiation.
Exactly. And that's what should be explored through discovery. That's what we should have been given a chance to undertake years ago. Whether or not the subsequent action succeeded to rescind, that's not a Rule 12 question. We have pled sufficient facts to indicate that there was an unequivocal renunciation when in year 5 the tenant indicates it's shutting down. And the same Rule 12 standard applies to the respondent's argument of waiver. I do want to point the court to a few things in regard to the lease just to tie out some of the questions that were raised. Section 19.07 of the lease on addendum page 25, Judge Connolly, you were looking for language talking about no waiver. That's where that is.
Oh, yes.
Section 19.07.
Got it.
Also, to transition and talk about the language of the guarantee, I think that there is a specific term of art here that's being overlooked. When we're talking about the guarantee, notwithstanding the foregoing, in the event the landlord terminates tenant's possession of the premises, the guarantor is liable for the lump sum payment. We never terminate it. This was a surrender. This was them walking out. That's incredibly different in the land in the realm of leasehold than a termination. Those are distinct terms of art. And again, if we're here making this quibble as to whether or not the tenant surrendered versus terminated, what actions went into this, that is what discovery is for. That is why we needed the opportunity to pursue this further. If they're going to make these arguments, those all go to fact questions. And in this case, what the court did was make improper determinations of fact on a Rule 12 motion. She did it in regard to the breach of guarantee claim, and she did it in regard to the unjust enrichment claim as well, too. If that ruling stands as it is, there really is no way I could ever plead an unjust enrichment claim in regard to a contract. Because the court has said, nope, you plead a contract. I am finding as a matter of fact and law that the contract contains all of the party's obligations, that this is it. There really is no way that I can ever then plead unjust enrichment as an alternative cause of action. And Rule 8.05 gives me the right to do that. Unless the court has further questions, those were the issues from the response that I wanted to point out.
Thank you for your arguments today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
I'm fine. Thank you, Louise.
Doing good.